You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 25th, 2012, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Bully.
How are you doing today, Evan?
I'm in a Winston Churchill kind of mood, so I'm doing just fine.
Winston okay. Churchill said ole?
No, he said bully.
Bully?
Oh, bully.
You know, when I'm looking for quotes, I find tons of Winston Churchill quotes. You
know,
not completely skeptically related, but the guy said so many cool things and at such a time in history when people really needed to hear those cool things. He was epic, man.
Without a doubt.
All right, Rebecca.
Winston Churchill, cool dude.
Yeah.
Hey, guess what today is? On January 28th, 1887, according to the Guinness Book of World Records, the world's largest snowflake fell during a snowstorm in Fort Keogh in Montana.
And just how big was this snowflake?
It was so big.
How big was it?
It's so big it got into the Guinness Book of World Records.
Shouldn't you say the world's biggest recorded snowflake?
Actually, it's not even really well recorded. Basically, just some guy said that he saw it. So it was a rancher named Matt Coleman.
While chewing on peyote or something.
For some reason, I just picture some guy like sitting at his window during a snowstorm, and he's looking up, and he sees this gigantic-ass snowflake, and he's like, hello. Hello, big boy. You know, and he runs out, and he catches it, and he measures it. And then, of course, he touches it by accident, and he melts the freaking thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is right? A sordid story.
How could That's it not be happened. That?
Well, Matt Coleman said that he saw a snowflake that was 15 inches wide. And
what?
Some places I saw reported 15 inches wide and 8 inches thick.
Rebecca, does the diameter matter with a snowflake?
But
like
anyway,
a
massive, a massive snowflake.
God, that's huge.
But, you know, we don't really know because the problem is that in 1887, cell phone cameras were few and far between. So we really only have his word. But I wanted to look into whether or not there have been any confirmed reports of snowflakes that were anywhere near that size. Since then, it turns out there have been confirmed snowflakes of up to 4 inches, which is nowhere near the same, but still pretty massive. 4 inches in Berlin in 1915, and also up to 3 inches in Laramie, Wyoming in 1970. And in 1992, field researchers used laser probes to measure snowflakes that were up to 2 inches wide with snow crystals the size of a pea in Newfoundland. And to make things clear, when I say snow crystal, I'm talking about that's like the usual six-armed star image that we all know and love. And the word snowflake usually refers to many of those crystals all clustered together in midair. And thousands of those crystals can cluster together to make up one giant snowflake that could be several inches across. So thanks to more and more field researchers out there studying climate and other things, we figured out the chain of events that lead to giant snowflakes. It happens when the temperature is just above freezing and winds are calm enough to not break up the flakes. Dendrites are the largest of the snow crystals. What happens is that they can form really high up, like 3 miles in the sky. So that gives them a lot of time to fall and bump into smaller crystals and accumulate, or snowball, if you will. And eventually you end up with massive flakes. But so far, nobody has any convincing evidence that they will get to 15 inches across. However, there's nothing in the laws of physics that says that it can't happen. Mm-hmm. So keep your eyes peeled.
Yeah, it's pretty thin evidence, though. I mean, 2 to 3 inches sounds more plausible.
Right.
Much.
I'm surprised Guinness even accepted it.
Yeah, because, you know, they're that bastion of proof.
Of science, yeah.
No, they're evidence. Generally, I thought they're fairly, you know, they're generally strict in documenting and making sure that it was actually done.
I think they were just trying to pad out their book.
All right, let's move on to some news items. Jay, you're going to tell us about a stem cell treatment for blindness.
Yeah, I was reading about a recent news item where some scientists were doing research on the stem cell treatment of the two most common types of blindness, and this is worldwide. But real quick, just a quick history on stem cells. So since 1998, when scientists discovered how to grow actual stem cells have been considered a promising source of replacement cells for regenerative medicine. And when I say that they discovered how to grow stem cells, we knew that stem cells have existed much longer than that, but scientists actually figured out a way to take existing stem cells and basically culture them to make them grow so they had a population that they could actually draw from and do testing with. And since then, stem cells have proven to be very difficult to work with because of their complexity. I mean, the way that stem cells are unique are that they can become any other type of cell that's in the organism depending on the environment that they're in.
Well, there are different kinds of stem cells. I mean, the embryonic stem cells can become any other kind of stem cell. But then there are more specific types of stem cells. Like there are blood stem cells that can become any kind of blood cell, but not non-blood cells.
So this recent study that we're talking about that was in the news uses embryonic stem cells on Stargardt's macular dystrophy and dry age-related macular degeneration. And like I said, these are the two leading causes of blindness in the developed world. This study was considered to be preliminary and designed to mostly take a look at the safety and the procedure, how they would actually use it. And they do have concerns of course, injecting stem cells into any part of the body, particularly the eye, because of the following reasons. And one of them, of course, is tumor formation. But they were saying that there wasn't any hyperproliferation. This is their language, which is an abnormally high rate of cell division, which is a cause of cancer or is cancer, abnormal cell growth, or the immune system rejection of the transplanted cells in either of the two patients that they tested. And they tested these people for 4 months after the procedures were done. Now, Steve, you were going to talk about the results that they found from the test, right?
Well, so to be clear, this was a preliminary study looking at safety only. Their only concern was, you know, can we inject stem cells into patients' eyes, basically into their retinas, without them forming tumors or other bad effects? Like, you know, you mentioned hyperplasia, also rejection, and will the cells survive and become the right kind of cells? So this is a preliminary test of two patients where they injected one eye and there were no negative outcomes in either of the two patients. So the stem cell injections appear to be safe. Although this study wasn't specifically looking at benefit, both patients also reported improved vision. The one patient, the scientists who did the study are saying that there appears to be a clear improvement in the vision of the eye that was injected.
Did they get supervision?
They did not get supervision or x-ray vision.
Oh, crap. Damn.
But the patient reported that, for example, she was able to read the time on her watch when she was not able to previously do that. The second patient also reported improved vision, but it's not clear that that's anything other than a placebo effect. She actually reported improved vision in the eye that was not injected, in both eyes, wow. But you know, including the eye that wasn't injected. So what's interesting about this study is, one is, you know, we're starting now to get the early reports of preliminary research of, you know, embryonic stem cell applications.
Took long enough.
Well, I mean, this is about right, actually. And we're still 5 to 10 years away, you know, even at this stage, if everything goes well. You know, they have to look at this in many more patients. They have to follow outcomes much more thoroughly. You know, they need longer-term follow-up to make sure these don't become tumors or increase the risk of developing cancer or have other problems. It takes 5 years to do a 5-year follow-up.
How do you figure that?
Before this is considered safe for doing routinely.
But the good news is that in the 4 months that they were following the patients, they didn't see anything that raised any red flags, which is fantastic. And also, I do believe that it legitimately did help that one of these subjects. You know, they're using very common eye tests on these people, and one of them is the basically reading of the eye chart, which you can't fake.
The only way to fake it is to memorize it.
The point here is, though, once again, you know, we're always saying 5 years, 5 years, you know, everything is seemingly 5 years away, but they did actually hit a milestone here.
Yeah, this is, I think, a recognizable milestone. The other thing I found interesting about it was the reporting of it by the scientists themselves. They were very conservative, very cautious, considering other interpretations of that, you know, this might be the placebo effect. We're not sure this is really a good effect, and emphasizing how much more research has to be done. And it always strikes me, I think it's important to note, the contrast between, you know, real scientists doing legitimate research, even here where you have a very sexy breakthrough treatment using stem cells to treat blindness, how cautious they're being. And to contrast that to the snake oil salesmen who use flimsy evidence to make these bold, expansive claims without the qualifiers and without the caution and you know that these scientists are stating. That says a lot about, and so that's a good sort of first approximation of when you're dealing with, in my opinion, like legitimate scientific medical research and snake oil salesmen.
Yeah, if the snake oil salesmen had these results, they'd be asking for like a Nobel Prize. They'd be selling the treatment on the internet and in China and anywhere else they could
sell
it.
Sometimes people send me links where I just find links to pseudoscientists, you know, cranks and quacks who are selling whatever they're selling. And it's unbelievable how hyped up their claims and their credentials are. It's like, this is the greatest breakthrough perhaps in 1,000 years. And they go over and over about how renowned this guy is. And he was invited to speak, you know, to this eminent congregation of scientists who had to get together to hear what this. I mean, it's like a movie, the way they're presenting it. It's just ridiculous. Whereas, you know, here you have actual scientists with a stunning milestone. I mean, this is still, you know, again, a long way away from an actual treatment. And they're downplaying it as much as possible.
As they should.
Yeah, as they should. So, Evan, tell us what's up with Sidney Crosby.
Yeah, well, we're about to hit the other end of the spectrum now with this particular news item. Like you said, Steve, Sidney Crosby is a big NHL superstar.
NHL,
National Hockey League.
Hockey.
Yes. Now, this guy was, you know, no slouch. He's the highly touted number one pick of the Pittsburgh Penguins. That's a hockey team. In 2005. And this guy was destined to become big-time superstar. I mean, he was being compared to Wayne Gretzky, Mario Lemieux. I mean, the greatest.
Wayne Gretzky.
Yeah.
It's like a crazy.
He scored a goal or two. You know, but really, his impact was immediately felt on the team. He scored 100 points his first season. He led his team back to the playoffs in 2007 after a long absence. He was the league's most valuable player that year. And then in 2009, they won the whole thing, the Stanley Cup championship. So on in this guy's back, he basically turned this franchise into a modern winner. But then in January of the 2010-2011 season, Crosby suffered a concussion during the NHL Winter Classic game, which was a highly watched televised game that's annually held in an outdoor venue, which is unusual for the NHL. It was a blindside hit that was kind of brutal, but it wasn't vicious, so it wasn't a cheap shot per se. It was just really bad hit. And it was a substantial injury, although he and the doctors didn't know it at the time. Crosby wound up finishing the game, and he played for a whole nother week before he suffered another hit to the head, and that sent him off the ice indefinitely. So this is the NHL's biggest star, and he had to sit out the rest of the season in hopes that things would get better in time so he could return to play for the start of the next season. So the summer of 2011, this is where the story becomes of interest to skeptics and the science-based medical community. In early September, Crosby and members of the Pittsburgh Penguins management held a press conference. But sitting alongside Crosby at the conference was a person with the name tag of Dr. Ted Carrick. Now, Carrick is a chiropractic neurologist. So what exactly is a chiropractic neurologist, right? It sounds like a bit oxymoronic to me. It's a chiropractor who applies their trade to people suffering from neurological disorders. And Steve, you had blogged about chiropractic neurology back in November and about Dr. Carrick specifically. And you found a very telling quote made by Dr. Carrick during a PBS interview he had given, in which he said, "Well, we're finding every day that more and more things that we didn't think were associated with the chiropractic treatment can be affected very nicely. There are testimonials from people who have had their eyesight and hearing back and people waking up from comas."
So let's contrast that with the eyesight researchers,
right?
The stem cells for vision who are trying to downplay it. This guy is like, oh yeah, we can cure coma. We could wake people, give them their eyesight back, hearing. Sure. Based on the flimsiest of testimonials. Which is mostly what this guy has. He just has anecdotes and testimonials. So chiropractic neurology is, as far as I could tell, 100% nonsense. It is not based upon any body of scientific knowledge, any understanding of neuroscience, neuroanatomy, or anything. It is just chiropractors trying to apply, you know, their voodoo to neurological disorders. Carrick has published a few studies, but they're laughably pseudoscientific. He published one study in which he claims that, first of all, he claims that you can tell something about brain function by looking at the blind spot, by mapping the blind spot of the eye. This is simply not true. He then claims that you can improve, i.e. reduce, the size of the blind spot in the eye by doing a chiropractic adjustment, which is absurd.
Wow.
Squared. You know, so this is his evidence, this kind of nonsensical research, which is terrible, and testimony and anecdote leading him to blithely claim, oh yes, we could wake people from coma. This is the guy treating Crosby, and also is relying upon just the placebo effect and testimony just to argue that his treatments are in fact helping. But there's no reason to think that Crosby's not just going through the normal period of recovery from a concussion.
Steve, even other chiropractors have spoken out against Carrick and his practices. And, you know, we know that there are some chiropractors that are trying to apply a real scientific approach to chiropractic. And one such chiropractor, David Seaman, had this to say about Carrick. He said, "In recent years, the work of Dr. Carrick has resulted in a style of dogmatism that echoes that of B.J. Palmer. In the case of Carrick, students believe that his words represent state-of-the-art referenced material. When an instructor implies that he is correct and accepted scientific texts are wrong, he fosters an instructor-student relationship that leads to unbridled dogmatism."
Right. Yeah, he's a guru.
Calling him out. As far as Crosby's concerned, at that press conference in September, Carrick boldly predicted that Sidney Crosby would be back and playing in time by Christmas, by around the Christmas season, is his recovery. And he specifically said, and I quote him, "Sidney shouldn't have any problems in the future, thanks to the practice of chiropractic neurology." Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? So much for not having any problems in the future for Sidney, because he did return to playing again in late November of 2011. He played in 8 games, and Sidney's symptoms all returned. And he's now, once again, inactive due to these symptoms reoccurring.
Just to clarify, it wasn't a new injury. It was just a recurrence of his symptoms from the previous injury because he was being too active. He was playing again.
That's right. Yeah. And the recent headlines from just last week said that Crosby is going back to Carrick again.
Yeah.
For more treatment.
Yeah, he has his hooks in him.
So, yeah, it's really unfortunate. You've got the biggest superstar right now in the NHL really helping carry the water for Carrick, in a sense. He's making him legitimate in a lot of people's eyes.
Yeah, it's going to be huge free advertising for him. He's getting so much press coverage. A lot of it, like Sports Illustrated, covered him very uncritically. Although in an earlier article, they did also quote a neurosurgeon who said, you know, that it was very critical of Carrick, saying that he's all based on anecdote and what we do today is based on evidence-based medicine. One more medical news item, by coincidence. Again, a number of people sent this to us. This has a little bit of a local angle for us. Also, a chiropractor. Again, this is not by design. This is just, you know, one of the things that we wanted to talk about. So in a small town, Leroy, New York, 12 teenage girls have come down with what the press is calling a mystery illness. You guys heard about this?
Mystery Science Illness.
I sure did.
3000.
Yeah. They all attend the same school. It's a middle school, high school. And all 12 of them are displaying symptoms that are being described as Tourette-like symptoms, that they're having these involuntary motor tics or movements. The question is, why would 12 girls all come down with the same, you know, constellation of symptoms over a short period of time? So, of course, there's, you know, the CDC has gotten involved. There is one neurologist who examined, I think, 11 of the 12 girls, who's been doing an extensive testing on all of them to try to figure out, is there anything environmental? But what caught our eye about this story was when a chiropractor by the name of Russell Karam, who is local to us, he's in a town nearby us, wrote an article about this situation and starts off okay. I mean, I think a little bit clunky, but, you know, saying that, you know, there's a cluster of cases, so there has to be an explanation that can accommodate that. You know, it can't be genetic because, you know, they're not genetically related. And eventually comes to the conclusion that it's got to be something environmental, which I think is actually a reasonable conclusion. But then he inappropriately narrows the list of what counts as environmental. It says that, well, okay, well, toxins and infections, you know, seems that they've been ruled out. So he comes to the conclusion that the environmental trigger, it was probably the HPV vaccine, Gardasil or Cervarix. That it would explain the timing, the, you know, the age, why it's all girls. So essentially he's trying to blame vaccines on this, on these symptoms. And he goes on to talk about, you know, that there's high levels of aluminum in the vaccine and that could be, you know, a cause of toxicity. And then he goes from there to saying how the government is untrustworthy and we can't trust the government, you know, to investigate this properly. So at the end, it just became an anti-vaccine crank diatribe. Where he most significantly goes off the rails is in dismissing the possibility that the environmental trigger here is psychological, because that is something else that these 12 girls share in common. They are all part of the same very small community attending the same small school. He writes, now the, in scare quotes, establishment has diagnosed them with conversion disorder, a disease resulting in similar symptoms, but usually brought on by some kind of stress or traumatic event. Actually, it wasn't the establishment. It was a neurologist who actually examined 11 of the 12 girls, ran a battery of tests, ruled out anything else that could link these together. And by the process of elimination, but also from direct examination and history taking, etc., concluded that this is a case of mass psychogenic illness, which happens. I mean, this is a known phenomenon and cannot be easily dismissed. I actually did find video of some of the girls displaying their symptoms. You know, so this is similar to, you know, previous cases that we've talked about, like if you remember the cheerleader, Desiree Jennings, who believes she had vaccine-induced dystonia. Movement disorders can be diagnosed by video because what's important is how they're moving. You know, so it's not a substitute for a complete neurological exam, but you can actually, you know, tell a lot just from a video of what the movement itself is. In this case, you know, what I'm seeing is something that does look like tics. I think a tic is the best technical description for the kind of movement that it is. A sudden, somewhat bizarre facial movement or gesture, maybe involving a vocalization. This could be compatible with a tic disorder or Tourette syndrome. I don't think I can say based upon the video alone that it's psychogenic, that it's psychological, because tics can be almost anything, you know. Although I will say that it's a little atypical. It certainly could be psychogenic also. I think the fact that, you know, there are 12 unrelated girls who were all affected over a short period of time without there being any detectable environmental trigger or other environmental trigger is pretty strong inference that it is psychogenic. These psychogenic episodes are much more common in women than men for whatever reason, so it kind of fits that profile as well. So it's interesting, you know, I think that this is a difficult kind of a situation to deal with in the press, you know, in public. This is something that should be dealt with between these families, physicians, and them, you know, because it's very delicate.
Yeah, and I think that the public aspect of this and the Desiree Jenkins case actually make it more difficult because of the bias against psychological mm-hmm. illnesses. You know, I think that people would rather have an obvious physical disability they can point to as opposed to a psychological illness, just because we, you know, we see people with psychological illnesses yeah. as nutso freaks, you know. So without the public aspect, I think there would be a better chance of them actually, you know, confirming that it's psychological and getting the correct
treatment. Yeah, I agree. There's a stigma attached to it. And because when it's made public, I mean, these girls are going on the news, going on TV, that invests them in the reality, you know, the organic basis of the illness to an extent that makes it would make it very hard for them to sort of just give it up. And it's hard enough as it is, you know, to get people to accept the diagnosis that it's psychogenic and to make it stop. It's something that's incredibly hard to treat. It becomes almost impossible if now, you know, it's been made public and they have that angle to it. Again, like with Desiree Jennings, I mean, she just became so invested in that, that it was just, I think it'd be hopeless, you know, to try to get them to get past this. So it's unfortunately very counterproductive. But a lot of, you know, if you read the comments, a lot of people have, you know, made the analogy to the Salem witch trials, where you essentially had a small group of young, you know, teenage girls who started manifesting symptoms that were blamed on witches, you know, at the time. But you know, in certain ways, very similar.
Yeah, and when, you know, when you start blaming vaccines instead, which helps feed into the idea that vaccines are dangerous and convinces more people to not get vaccinated, then you could even say that they have a similar level of danger to them as the witch trials.
Yeah, I mean, this is a witch hunt against vaccines. It is very similar. Yeah. All right, well, let's move on. Let's move on first to Who's That Noisy? Evan, give us the answer to last week.
Here we go. Last week's Who's That Noisy?
There's no such thing as a psychic.
You guys remember that?
Yes, I do. That's from TV.
There's no such thing as a psychic.
Nope,
nope.
From a movie.
It sounds like it's from TV. It's actually from a movie. The movie is Ed Wood, one of my all-time favorite movies. Wonderful.
Really?
Movie.
I've never seen that. I have to see that.
Oh, you must see. Must see movie, Bob. You will not be disappointed. It is one of Tim Burton's finest, in my opinion.
Yeah, Burton and Depp. How could I not see that?
Right? You totally should see it. They were wonderful. But that was actor Jeffrey Jones portraying the amazing Criswell, mm-hmm. who was, of course, an actual psychic at the time.
Well, stage, you know, psychic.
Not really psychic. Just a showman. Because he basically admitted in that same scene in the movie to Ed Wood that he said, it's all horseshit.
Yeah.
That's basically what he says. I just guess. People believe me because I wear a tuxedo.
Yeah, it's all showmanship.
So while he admitted that, certainly to his friends, he was quoted as saying once that he once had the gift, but he lost it when he started taking money.
Yeah, so you can't take that evil money.
So it's,
otherwise, yeah, your powers go away.
Yeah, your cosmic energy that, you know, plummets at that point.
Right. Wasn't that in that James Bond movie where the tarot card reader, her power went away because she had sex with James Bond?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
It's one.
Yeah, so you can't take money.
He stole the mojo.
And that's what Sean Connery said. Oh, I bet you didn't see that coming.
Although it might have been not Sean Connery. I think it was
Roger Moore.
All right. Who got that correct?
A lot of people actually guessed it was The Mentalist, mm-hmm. right? You know,
similar thing.
Because it's similar, but, you know, there was that music in the background, right, Rebecca, that you noticed last week. And so it was, you know, you have to know the movie perhaps as in-depth as I know it, you know, which is almost line for line. We had no winners, so I was able to stump
clean sweep
our listening audience.
Good job.
So we're going to do something a little different this week.
A lot different.
And you're right. It is a lot different.
It's a kind of an experiment. That's what we do in January.
I'm scared.
Don't be frightened. Hold my hand. Here, hold my hand. Wait, that's not my hand. We're going to have a Who's That Noisy scavenger hunt. So instead of me playing a noisy for you this week, I am tasking you, the listening audience, to come up with the correct noisy for us and the listening audience, of course. You must submit to us. I challenge you to submit to us the dumbest thing that, in your opinion, that a politician has said concerning science, or a scientific statement that is just so stupid, but a politician must have said it. Send us your submission. Send us your audio clip.
Yeah, it's got to be an actual audio clip.
Has to be an audio clip, right?
Link to it, not a transcript. We need the audio clip.
It's a podcast.
Yeah.
After all, it is.
And brief.
And yes, breathe.
And your underwear. Yes.
Right.
I understand politicians, their mouths move all the time and lots of dumb things come out of their mouths. But keep it brief. All
and,
right?
And give us the information. You're not trying to stump us. We will select the dumbest thing that, you know, statement that people send us, and we'll play that next week.
And we will play it next week for your listening enjoyment. All right. So you have your homework, and we're looking forward to seeing what you come up with.
Yeah.
I know I am.
It should be fun. It should be fun.
Yep.
Okay. Well, thank you, Evan.
You are welcome.
We're going to do one email this week. And Rebecca, you're going to take the lead on this. Do you want to read the email?
Sure. Here we go. Michael from Ohio writes, "Hello, Skeptics Guide. During my daily science news story search on the internet, I came across a couple of stories about strange apocalyptic sounds coming from the sky from Canada to Budapest. Having some critical thinking, I began to inspect the videos to try and discern what they were. After much failed research on more worthy sites, I could not find a good answer. To me, it sounds like it could be something simple, like a plane flying overhead, to something more atmospheric. But these are wild guesses. I thought you may want to look into it, so that you may have better luck than me finding out what it actually is." Then he gives us a link. And so I checked it out. And it's true, strange sounds coming from the sky have taken YouTube by storm. I'm taking this story because, as you all know, I do have an ongoing segment on SGU called Things People See in the Sky and Mistake for Other Possibly Paranormal Things. This is related, only instead of seeing, it's hearing. And I'm going to give you a warning at right from the outset here. I'm going to explain some of the videos, but as soon as I do, someone's going to upload a new video using a new trick, and somebody will have to start all over again to debunk it. So remember, a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing. That said, creepy sounds are probably about as common as creepy sights, but for some reason, photos of UFOs tend to get more attention than recordings of those weird bleeps and bloops and rumbles in our lives. The rumbles, when they have a most likely natural origin, are known as brontides, which we've talked about before. They're deep booming sounds that seem to come from very far away, like there's no definite source that you can pinpoint. They're often heard near bodies of water, like with the guns of Seneca at Seneca Lake in New York, or the Barizal guns near the Bay of Bengal. They could be caused by thunder, natural gas explosions, seismic activity, or some people even think possibly waves of water hitting at resonant hollows. And they can easily be confused with man-made sounds like sonic booms, artillery, construction, stuff like that. There's also the bloop. I think we've talked about that. It's an ultra-low frequency sound that was detected underwater by the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in 1997. That's NOAA. It was several times louder than our loudest known creature, which is the blue whale, and nobody knows what caused it. NOAA, in addition to the bloop, has found five other sounds of unknown origin underwater. So that's kind of scary and fun. And even fairly well-known animals can make sounds that scare people. Like owls, foxes, fisher cats, and even rabbits can actually sound like people screaming, for instance. Very creepy sounds. So all of these weird sounds can freak people out in much the same way that satellites and the moon and stars and weather balloons can freak people out when they're not sure what they're looking at. So ordinarily, if you go on YouTube, you can find a lot of videos of people who have recorded sounds that genuinely scare the crap out of them. However, if you go on YouTube to search for strange sounds these days, you will most likely only find lies, bald-faced lies. And that's what our email has written in about. I first became aware of these about around January 12th or so. That's when blogs started picking up on this huge influx of videos featuring creepy sounds. All that week, there were an insane number of videos being uploaded from all around the world, like the emailer says, the US, Canada, Brazil, Russia, Australia, and they all claimed to demonstrate a creepy sound, sort of like, most of them sounded sort of like trumpets signaling the oncoming apocalypse or something. So I'll play you an example.
Can anyone else hear that noise? Listen. What the hell is that?
Thank you.
Okay. That was from Melbourne, Australia. And that's one of the first ones I saw. Now, I found that one kind of suspicious because in the video, there's no one around, even though the guy seems to be asking someone if anyone can hear the noise. So I decided to do a little digging. I got the audio off of YouTube and I threw it into Audacity, which is the free sound editing program that we all use to record the show. And I noticed that it's in stereo, which made me very happy because I don't know a whole lot about audio, but I do know that there's this really neat trick you can do with a stereo track that you think might have been manipulated. You could also use this trick if you want to make karaoke songs. You see, if the manipulator of the video is particularly lazy or just ignorant, they might actually record their audio in mono, but then add a stereo sound effect to it. Stereo meaning like there's a left channel and a right channel, so you hear different things in each ear. Mono, you hear the same thing in each ear. So Audacity has this free plugin called Center Pan Removal, which basically inverts one of the channels and then puts the audio back together again, causing the mono sounds to cancel each other out, and you're left hearing only the stereo sound. So I did that. And 10 seconds later, this is the exact same clip you just heard, but with the mono gone. So you may notice there's a bit of silence where there used to be a man talking. And then the creepy sound. Isn't that convenient?
So this is a stereo effect added to a mono track.
Exactly. Or maybe the angels of the apocalypse broadcast in magical stereo that bypasses mono devices. Or, yes, this is actually a complete and utter fake. And not just like a whoops, I made a mistake. You know, I thought it was a ghost, but it's not fake. This is someone who went into an audio program and added that sound. And as for the actual sound, it doesn't really matter what it is, and it could be any number of things, but I happen to have watched Kevin Smith's film Red State last month. It's free on Netflix Watch Instantly. And spoiler alert, everyone, don't listen if you haven't seen the movie. If you want to see the movie, I'll be honest, not that good of a movie, but spoiler. At the end of the movie, there's an apocalyptic trumpeting sound. And seriously, this is a big spoiler, even though not a good movie. The trumpeting in the movie is actually caused by some kids playing a prank on a Christian doomsday cult. So I thought this, the sound you just heard in the Melbourne clip, I thought it sounded kind of familiar. So I went and I found that clip of Red State, and I will play it for you now.
Now, where have I heard that before?
It sounds
so familiar.
That should sound pretty familiar to you. I mean, maybe it's not. Maybe it's something different. But yeah, those do sound remarkably similar to me. And there are a number of other videos that use a remarkably similar sound. So you can keep an ear out for that. I was ready to just say that this is a sound that comes from some sci-fi movie. But just a few hours ago, one of my Twitter followers, not in my name 2050, I'm sorry, I don't know your real name, but I guess that's appropriate for your username. But anyway, not in my name 2050 pointed me to a video by YouTuber Voodoo6 in which he figures out that that came directly from the 2008 film War of the Worlds. So
yeah, I recognize that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like most people skipped that film.
No,
but
yeah, that was the
just
that was,
Tom Cruise was in it.
I mean, it was it was a mediocre movie, all things considered. But I loved the Martian or whatever machines, and they made a noise that was legitimately scary.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Some of these videos are pretty scary. You know, if you can sort of put yourself in that mindset.
Yeah.
The short version is, don't worry, the apocalypse is not until October, at least.
That's right.
So you're fine.
Right. All right. Well, thanks, Rebecca. Let's move on to our interview. We are joined now by Sean Carroll. Sean, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hi, happy to be here.
And Sean is a theoretical physicist at Caltech. He is the author of the popular book From Eternity to Here, and also authors a popular blog, Cosmic Variance, which is hosted over at Discoverer Blogs. So Sean, tell us about your research.
Well, I'm a theoretical physicist specializing in cosmology, gravity, particle physics, things like that. So I care about, you know, what the universe is made of, where it came from, where it's going, dark matter, dark energy, stuff like that. And especially these days, I care about the very, very beginning, the origin of the universe, and why it was so finely tuned in various ways. In particular, why it was so low entropy, why it was so orderly, which gives us the arrow of time here in our later universe.
So the little questions, then.
Yeah, you know, I mean, just something to keep me busy, really. Yeah. Keep me off the streets.
That's a lot of stuff that we actually talk about frequently on this show, though none of us are theoretical physicists, so we do the best we can. Let's start first with dark matter. So what's the bottom line? Is that stuff real? Are we past the point now where we could say, listen, all right, there's definitely dark matter, and let's just move on from there?
Yes. I would answer that by saying yes, that we are definitely beyond that point. Truth in science compels me to say that not everyone agrees, but everyone should agree, because it's true. We have for a long time hypothesized dark matter. It goes at least back to the 1970s, arguably back to the 1930s. But it was always indirect, and it still is indirect, by which we mean we detect the gravitational pull of the dark matter, but we don't detect the dark matter itself. We're trying to detect the dark matter itself, but you could always imagine that we were being tricked, that gravity didn't work the way that we thought it did, so there was more gravity than we would have thought. But these days, we've seen multiple examples of a gravitational field pulling in the direction where there is no ordinary matter. And that seems to be most consistent with dark matter. We don't know how to do that any other way other than imagining that there is dark matter of some sort. So I would say that we can make that case and move on to trying to figure out what it is.
But do you think, it's interesting that your specialty also is in gravity, do you think there's anything to the modified Newtonian dynamics, you know, the notion that maybe there is something different about our understanding of gravity at large, large scales? Maybe that doesn't explain everything, and we still need there to be dark matter, but maybe there also is this something funky about gravity, or again, do you think that that is the wrong alley?
I suspect it's the wrong alley. I'm not fundamentally opposed to the idea. I think it would be an awesome idea if it were true. I've written papers myself about modifying gravity and what the effects would be. However, we make progress. We move on. And I think right now we're at the point where modifying gravity is clearly not enough. We also need dark matter. And if that's true, if you can answer the questions with dark matter and not modifying gravity, but you can't answer the questions by modifying gravity without dark matter, then I think the case is very weak. It's not that it's impossible to modify gravity, but it's not what you would expect theoretically. Theoretically, you'd expect if gravity is modified, it should be at short distances and high energies, not long distances in astrophysics and cosmology. So it's theoretically problematic. It's experimentally unnecessary. I would not put a lot of money betting that gravity is modified.
Yeah, that seems to be the consensus that we get with the people that we talk to. But it's interesting. You still see it crop up in news items. And we've also talked about this phenomenon, the notion that sometimes there's like a 99%, 1% asymmetry in the scientific community, but science news reporters don't seem to get that. They just say, oh, look, some scientists think that there's modified Newtonian dynamics and others think that there's dark matter, and they present it as more equal. Do you see that too, and does that frustrate you?
I do see it a little bit. I mean, I see in many, many times, in many ways, let's put it in the most general possible form, the view of what is interesting in science that you get from the popular press is different than the view of what is interesting in science that you would get to by talking to professional scientists. And part of that is just inevitable. Part of that is that what is interesting to outsiders is different than what is interesting to scientists, because scientists have a lot of I's to dot and T's to cross and things that are important but just don't translate immediately into popular interest. But also, it's hard to let go of some things, you know? I mean, it's hard when a charismatic and smart scientist says that something is interesting and true. You can't blame journalists for reporting it as interesting and true, even if lots of other people in the scientific community would say, you know, I think we know better than that now.
Yeah, although I do blame them a little bit. I mean, in that I can understand how they might react that way, but isn't it their job to know how to cover science and to ask the right questions? Like, is this a minority view? Is this a real controversy? Where's the asymmetry? And I think the failure to do that is a journalistic failure, you know, and I don't know how we can't let them entirely off the hook, in other words.
No, I don't. And I don't let either scientists or journalists entirely off the hook. I mean, I'm very happy to say that journalists should do a better job in accurately reflecting what are the consensus views of the science community. On the other hand, there are, you know, highly qualified PhD scientists specializing in cosmology who don't quite seem to see what is right in front of the nose on their faces, as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, no one is blameless here. I can blame everyone and tell everyone that they should believe what I know to be the truth and the world would be a better place.
Right.
Nice.
Right.
So if you had to take your personal guess, what do you think it is?
I don't want to weasel out, but I don't have a personal guess for what the dark matter is. It's a particle of some sort. There, that's my guess. It's some particle. It's not a particle that we've detected yet. All the particles that we know about in the laboratory don't have the right properties to be dark matter. It's easy to come up with new models where you do have a particle with the right properties to be dark matter. I've done it myself. I'm doing it again right now. But we don't quite have enough data to narrow it down. So the problem is that there's too many theories that are plausible and would fit the data to have it right now. Everyone's favorite model, most people's favorite model, is a WIMP, a weakly interacting massive particle. It turns out that if you have a massive particle that interacts via the weak interactions of particle physics and nothing else, then the numbers just work out. You get about the right density of mass in that particle in the late universe to be the dark matter. So once that happens, you know, once you don't have to work too hard and you get something that is robust and fits the data, people like that. Whereas other theories, you have to sort of bend over backwards and touch your toes and so forth. But that doesn't mean it's right.
So, Sean, then a WIMP then would kind of be a neutrino. I know it's not a neutrino because there's not enough of them to really account for it, but it would be something like a neutrino, something that has some mass, but just is so weakly interacting that you can't detect it conventionally, except through gravity.
Something like that. You know, a neutrino is, it has a mass, and it's neutral, and it interacts through the weak interactions. And a WIMP would be also all of those things. The difference is that neutrinos are probably 1/1000th of an electron volt in mass. An electron volt is a unit of energy or mass. So a proton is 1 billion electron volts. A neutrino is 1/1000th of an electron volt. And the WIMP is probably hundreds of times as massive as a proton, so hundreds of billions of electron volts. Much, 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 much heavier than a neutrino, but otherwise similar.
Did you ever see that Star Trek episode where they have the matter guy and the antimatter guy, and they meet each other, and then they cancel each other out?
I don't remember that episode. I remember similar episodes. Antimatter people wear beards or goatees, as I recall. But I mean, there is antimatter in the universe. You know, we don't want to give the whole lesson of particle physics every time. But antimatter is not the dark matter either. Antimatter would blow things up, and the universe actually is full of stuff that could blow up if there was a lot of antimatter out there. So that's right out.
Hey, Sean, do you have any thoughts about how we are going to one day be able to physically detect it? Any ideas, any things in the pipeline or in the works that you foresee that they're, you know, going to be chipping away at that will get us closer to the answer?
Oh, yeah, we're actually plausibly quite close to detecting the dark matter. There are multiple experiments that are dedicated to doing exactly that. Several of them have seen hints of signals. The problem is that they're just hints, and they haven't been confirmed yet, and they could go away. This is a very, very hard project. But we're doing three things. Number one, we're trying to directly detect the dark matter, which means we're building big detectors underground that are waiting for a dark matter particle to come in and bump into the detector. Number two, we're trying to indirectly detect the dark matter, which means that in space, two dark matter particles can sometimes come together and annihilate and give off gamma rays, and we can detect those gamma rays, and we're looking for that. And finally, you can make the dark matter at the Large Hadron Collider or at another particle accelerator. You could smash protons together and have dark matter come out. That's certainly one of the goals of the LHC, as it is going great guns these days.
Mm-hmm. So you think in 10 years or so, we may actually have direct evidence of dark matter? And those experiments, are they all looking for WIMPs, these weakly interacting massive particles, or could they find dark matter in another form?
They're not all looking for WIMPs. That's mostly what they're looking for. But, you know, it doesn't need to be 10 years. It could be this year.
Okay.
Very easily.
Okay. Could be any time.
That kind of leads into a quick question I had. I remember a while back, the other candidate besides WIMPs were MACHOs, the massive compact halo objects. Has that idea been abandoned at this time?
Well, MACHOs exist, but it was just, you know, the astrophysicists just couldn't help themselves in naming them MACHOs once you had WIMPs out there as a candidate for the dark matter. But it's not really a parallel idea. MACHOs are ordinary matter in the form of dark planets or stars that you don't see. But dark matter is not ordinary matter. It's not just matter that is dark. It's a kind of matter that is not ordinary, that is not protons, neutrons, electrons, or anything like that. So MACHOs exist, but not nearly enough to be the dark matter. The dark matter we know has to be something different.
Is that still baryonic matter, though, the WIMPs, or no?
Yeah, so when I said ordinary matter, the technical term would be baryonic matter, the kind of matter that we know about here on Earth, atoms, right? Protons, neutrons, and electrons in various forms. So any form of atom, any form of protons, neutrons, electrons, and so forth, that's ordinary matter. That's 4% of the total energy budget of the universe. Dark matter is an extra 23% of the universe. There's a whole huge amount of dark matter out there that can't be in the form of ordinary baryons and stuff.
I see, okay. So by definition, it's non-baryonic. Okay.
That's right. Dark matter. I mean, this, you know, this is a little bit of progress that sneaked up on us. When I was a graduate student, it wasn't at all clear that there was non-baryonic dark matter. There was evidence for it, but it wasn't airtight. And these days, we just know a lot more. We've done a lot more precision cosmology.
Yeah.
We know the total amount of stuff in the universe. We know there's dark energy. We believe the limits on ordinary matter that we get from a variety of sources, including the cosmic microwave background. So we just have enormously better constraints on what the universe is made of. And so the inventory is basically settled. It's just a matter of finding that dark matter and dark energy.
We talked just now about matter and antimatter. And that leads to, sounds like, to a question that you're interested in, and that is, you know, in terms of the origin of the universe, why is there matter? Why is there an excess of matter over antimatter? Is that something that your research touches on? Or?
Yeah, I mean, not in any productive way. I guess I've written one paper in my life about why there is more matter than antimatter. So that could be productive. You never know. I shouldn't downplay my own paper, but it's not been one of my real focuses. I haven't had any really good ideas. It's an area where there are plenty of good ideas. It's hard to distinguish between them on the basis of the data. It's just a problem where, you know, our understanding of how particle physics operates proceeds energy by energy. As we get more and more energetic particle accelerators, we open up more and more windows onto how particles operate. But the relevant processes that we suspect might be involved in making an asymmetry between matter and antimatter operate at much higher energies than we can reach here on Earth. They were there in the Big Bang, no problem, but we just don't have access to them right here. So it's a little bit underdetermined. It's certainly a big problem. And there's certainly good ideas for it. It's not like we have no idea what's going on or anything like that. It's just that we don't quite know how to distinguish between the reasonable-sounding alternatives.
The LHC won't get up to high enough energies to address that question?
Well, if we get lucky, it could. But, roughly speaking, there are two really promising-looking energy scales to look at in particle physics, known roughly as the weak scale and the gut scale. The weak scale is characteristic of the weak interactions of particle physics, maybe 100 or 1,000 times the mass of a proton. The gut scale is the grand unification scale, where all the forces are supposed to come together. That's up at 1,000 trillion times a mass of a proton or more. And so much, 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 much bigger. And the Large Hadron Collider will be looking at the weak scale. That's why we're so excited. We're looking at something that is really important. We've been waiting to look at it for 30 or 40 years now, and finally we'll get a peek. But it will, it falls short by 15 orders of magnitude looking at the gut scale. So there's plenty of room for things that we're not going to be able to probe with the LHC.
So, Sean, you're a physicist, and you've also published popular works. You have a blog. Do you get contacted by a lot of cranks trying to explain to you their theory of everything?
I have already gotten contacted once since this conversation began. I get emails every day.
That was just Bob,
from people though. From people who have fear.
Theory is going to work out.
It's a fine line. I used to read them, and then I used to save them. Now they go right to the virtual circular file, except that if it's a question, especially if it's from a student or if it's from someone younger than 25 or older than 70, I will try to answer it because those people are most likely to have questions. In between those ages, people are most likely to tell me the answers and say, here is the right theory of everything. I hope that someone will finally listen to me, and I've printed it out on my dot matrix printer, and I have a program that I wrote on my IBM PC to verify it. And I don't pay much attention to those.
Did you happen to catch, we talked about this, I think, one or two weeks ago, there was an article written by Wertheimer, I believe, who talking about these physics cranks and the fact that they're clamoring for attention from real physicists like you, and she was trying to make the argument that maybe we shouldn't be so dismissive of them. We were not complimentary to that opinion in discussing it. But so just interesting, just for the follow up to get. So any physicist whose name is accessible just gets overwhelmed with this.
I do, yeah. I mean, and I know Margaret Wertheim, the one person you're talking about, wrote a book, and she's quite smart, and I understand what she's trying to say. The crank phenomenon is sociologically incredibly interesting. I think that there's essentially nothing that it adds to the progress of science, because science is hard, even for there's many reputable scientists who won't quite admit that dark matter exists right now. And I don't think that the problem is people who just make stuff up. It's people who think they can get the right answer just by thinking about it without asking what anyone else has ever thought about. And one of the ways I put it to them face to face is, you're asking me to spend time reading and understanding your theory. So before I do that, I would like you to take the time to read and understand my theory, which is every working scientist theory, namely the Standard Model of Particle Physics based on quantum field theory plus general relativity. Very, very few of these people have really mastered the basics that any graduate student who gets a PhD in this field has mastered a long time ago. So I do think that there's some fields that attract people like this, the ones where the questions are easy enough to phrase that people can take a stab at answering them. What is gravity? What is healthy for you? How did evolution happen? Things like that. If you have questions about what is the cross section of a pi meson that interacts with a k meson, no cranks are really working at that out because they don't know what it means and they don't care about it. So that's a telltale sign right there.
I partially blame that bastard Einstein for a lot of these cranks.
Well, Einstein he did us a great disservice by failing to get a job early and going to the patent office. and that gives you know, a lot of license to people to say, you know, Einstein today would never have succeeded. What they don't appreciate is that Einstein understood the physics of his time better than anyone. And he was not an outsider in that sense at all. He was very much working within the system. He just had trouble getting a job, which a lot of good people do.
Well, Sean, thanks again for joining us. This has been a fascinating conversation. We had a good time.
Sure, my pleasure.
And again, for those who would like to read more about such topics, you can find his blog at Cosmic Variance on Discovery Blogs, and you could buy his book From Eternity to Here. You have anything else in the works that's coming out soon?
I am in the midst, not really the midst, the very, very, very beginning stages of writing a book about the Higgs boson, which hopefully will be discovered this year.
That's the question. Never seen it.
If you've seen the Higgs boson, let me know, because that will go in the book. We're you know, as you know, the Large Hadron Collider last year saw some tantalizing hints that maybe we've finally seen pieces of evidence for the Higgs boson, and it's very, very plausible that sometime this year or maybe next year, we'll say once and for all we found it. So I'm going to try to explain why people should care about that and tell some fun stories about it.
All right. Thanks again, Sean.
All right. My pleasure. Thanks, everyone.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And you all can play at home. Is everyone ready for this week?
Ready to play.
Got some good items this week. Item number one, chemists have created the first completely synthetic cell membrane. Item number two, physicists have created the first atomic X-ray laser. And item number three, new computer models show that adding sulfate particles to the stratosphere to reflect the sun's light could completely compensate for the effects of man-made global warming. Jay, for no reason at all, why don't you go first?
Okay, the first one about the chemist that created the completely synthetic cell membrane. Wow, that's really amazing if they actually came up with something that could function as a real cell membrane. The reason why I don't think this one is true is because I do know that things pass through the cell membrane. And I think that that would be too complicated for them to be able to figure out. I really think that would be amazing if they did, and I find it highly unlikely that they actually successfully did that. The second one about the physicists have created the first atomic X-ray laser. Wow. That sounds very powerful and very scary and very cancer-causing. New computer models that show that adding sulfate particles to the stratosphere to reflect the sun's light could completely compensate for the effects of man-made global warming. Well, God, doesn't that sound like really easy? Like that would just solve the man-made global warming problem just like that. But, you know, I really don't think they came up with a fake cell membrane, so I'd have to, even though this one sounds kind of too good to be true, I'm going to go with the cell membrane as the fake.
Okay, Evan?
Creating the first completely synthetic cell membrane. Well, I imagine we've established that a partial synthetic cell membrane has happened at some point, but now it's complete, which is on both levels news to me. So I don't have a good feeling for this one. The second one about physicists creating the first atomic X-ray laser. I mean, that, you know, has 1949 screaming written all over it. You know, how cool, you know, right off a comic book. Atomic X-ray laser. Very cool stuff. So its coolness factor is definitely playing a role in my thought. The third one I think I'm perhaps the most confident about, at least I feel. Adding sulfate particles to stratosphere reflecting the sun's light could completely compensate for the effects of man-made global warming. I think the only possibility of that being wrong is completely compensate. It probably would help, at least, but completely compensate? That's a little tricky. Perhaps it's between that one and the cell membrane. Yeah, I guess theoretically you could completely compensate, perhaps, at least in theory. I don't know if you practically do it, or they're probably going to give it a try, though. I'll say the synthetic cell membrane one also. I'll say that one's fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, I don't have as much of a problem with the synthetic cell membrane. I really hope it's true. There was lots of talk. I think it was Wegener's group last year created the first synthetic cell, but actually the membrane was completely biological, and they didn't create it. So this is like the missing thing that we really need. for synthetic life. And I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if our ability to manipulate self-organizing molecules has gotten to the point where they could actually create a membrane, even with the complicated portals into through the cell membrane. I wouldn't even be surprised if they were able to create that. Let's see, the X-ray laser. Yeah, another one. That's another one that I really hope it's true. That would really help us examine minute time spans and really get close-up looks on lots of different things. So that would be cool, too. I'm not seeing any, I can't think of anything that makes that outrageously not plausible. The third one, though, I have a problem with, the sulfate particles in the stratosphere. I could see them putting particles in the stratosphere and then increasing the albedo of the Earth to minimize global warming. But then you also have, wouldn't it also prevent radiation from leaking out and create kind of like a greenhouse effect too? So I'm not sure how that would balance out. And they completely compensate. Yeah, I've got a problem with that as well. So for those two reasons, I'm going to say the sulfate particles is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca.
Yeah, right out of the gate, I got to say, first atomic X-ray laser has to be science, not because it fits in with anything I know about current technology, but because it's awesome. I'm just going to say it again. Atomic X-ray laser. If any of our listeners are working
so cool
on that, like, please write in and let us know, because you win coolest research area of the year. So there's that. Oh, and also, please, nobody who's working on that become a supervillain. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah, right.
Making the first synthetic cell membrane. That's cool. That's really great. But it is just the membrane. So while I can see that that would be a huge achievement, it's not outside of the realm of possibility to me. It's the, making all the jiggly things inside of it from scratch that I think is the real tricky thing. I'm leaning towards Bob on this one, because I do know that because I once did a YouTube video about how chemtrails are not a real thing, and I've had a million people point out that, well, the government has tried, this stuff to help global warming. I do know that releasing sulfates into the air is one of the methods that people suspect will be used to combat man-made global warming. However, like Bob, I am skeptical of the completely compensate language. So I'm going to go ahead and say that one's the fiction.
So you all agree that physicists have created the first atomic X-ray laser.
Why not?
And so in fact, cool. It was engineers who created the first atomic X-ray laser.
You got us all,
that
Steve.
That one is science.
Hooray.
I'm sure there were
very
some engineers
cool
involved with that. But yeah, this is, how could I not go with that title?
That's such a great...
It is. And you do sort of imagine this massive thing in the hands of a supervillain, although I suspect Bob is very familiar with this item because it actually deals with the very small. Scientists working at the U.S. Department of Energy National Accelerator Laboratory have created the shortest, purest X-ray laser pulses ever achieved. This also was something that was predicted should be possible 45 years ago. So this is 45 years in the making. What's good, very useful about X-rays is that their wavelength is very short. So that means you can use it to visualize very small things. So this is something that could actually explore things at the atomic level, looking at biological molecules at work, etc. So it's actually a small, low-energy, short, very short pulse laser that would be very useful in science as a new window on looking at very brief and very small things, but not the kind of thing that you use to like blow up ships or something. Yeah. Right. All right. Let's go back to number one.
Yeah.
Chemists have created the first completely synthetic cell membrane. Jay and Evan, you think this one is the fiction?
That's correct.
And this one is science.
Yay.
Oh, hooray. Damn. Wow.
High five, Rebecca.
Good job, Bob. Good high five.
So, fake.
Audio Steve will fake. Fix it in post.
Yeah, right. Just like your segment, Rebecca.
Just don't make it in stereo.
You're just a glorified faker like all those YouTube clowns.
It's true.
You didn't fool any of us.
Yeah, so the membrane of cells is what we call a bilipid layer, bilipid membrane. There are molecules that are water-loving at one end and water-phobic or water-hating at the other end. Yes, hydrophilic and hydrophobic. So the if you put these lipid molecules into water, what they will do is they will the hydrophobic ends will all line up together on the inside with the hydrophilic ends on towards the outside, towards the water. But it was difficult. I mean, they had to do the right formula to get this to occur. These are researchers at the University of California, San Diego, and at Harvard University. And what they did was they created molecules that had the hydrophobic and the hydrophilic end, but they had to use a catalyst to make the reaction happen, to make this them form up in that way. They emphasize that that no part of this derived from or touched any living cell. This is completely synthetic, and that's the first time that anyone has accomplished that. Of course, they talk about extrapolating this, saying that they would like to continue to develop this kind of technology to the point of developing an entirely synthetic cell, literally an organism that is no part of which derives from any existing life.
Life from non-life.
Yeah, that's a very different thing than what they're doing, which is just creating the outer shell, but it is one step.
Yeah, and it's more synthetic than the synthetic cell that was all over the news last year.
Yeah, which was tweaked, but it was the actual membrane and the stuff of the cell was actually taken from another cell. It was just the genetic code that was altered that was synthetic, yeah.
Yeah, but even that wasn't completely synthetic.
It was not developed from scratch. Yeah, you're right. All right, so all of that means that new computer models show that adding sulfate particles to the stratosphere to reflect the sun's light could completely compensate for the effects of man-made global warming is fiction. What the computer models actually showed was that adding sulfate particles to the stratosphere would have a fairly modest effect. It would have some effect on reflecting the sun's light, but it would not come anywhere near to compensating for the effects of CO2 in the atmosphere. So their model was that it would not abate global warming. Also, there would be lots of unintended nasty consequences. All things considered, not a good idea.
Like stinky
air.
Yeah,
not a good idea to add sulfate particles to the atmosphere. Yeah.
Poison. Yeah.
It's also kind of scary because there's no weather in the stratosphere, so it's not like it's going to eventually rain down. It's like once it's there, it's going to be there for quite a while. So if you're like, well, oh, we put a little too much, it's like, well, okay, sorry.
Well, that'll lead to a new invention, the,
vacuum.
The vacuum, right? The
shaped like a
the
big
salt, the sulfate.
Spaceship
sucker.
Made.
Yeah, yeah.
Like yeah, I don't get a good feeling
exactly.
About these sort of big engineering projects that are attempting to compensate for one problem by creating another one. Again, I always go back mentally to the King of the Mice and the Cheese story, where you have to get the cats to chase the mice away, then you got to get rid of the cats. Then you have a cat problem. Then you get dogs to get rid of the cats, and you have a dog problem. So I don't know. Yeah, adding sulfate to the atmosphere.
You have a lizard problem.
I like them. They're cool. This was it geoengineering? It's fascinating. I think some of the stuff we'll be able to do eventually one day would be pretty amazing. But I just like the ones that are reversible, that are relatively easily reversible.
Like all that carbon we've been putting in the atmosphere.
Right.
Oh, wait.
What cares global warming?
Right. All right, so good work, Bob and Rebecca.
Mm-hmm.
Bob, that's right. Bob's 100% still.
100, and it's going to stay that way.
Evan, I believe, is still at 0%.
100%, baby.
100%.
I'm giving you a run for your money, Bob. Yeah. Well, it's like playing high-low poker, right?
Yeah.
It's exactly what this is.
All right, Jay, you got a quote for us?
Yeah, this quote was sent in by a web developer from Auckland, New Zealand named Gold, which I've never heard that name before. And the reason why I am I'm telling you about him is that he is actually walking the length of New Zealand to raise funds for the people that suffered from the Christchurch earthquake. And his website is intentionallyhomeless.org. And you could go and you can donate money for his cause. But he actually did send in a very cool quote, which I'm about to read to you. And the quote is, "There is a cult of ignorance in the United States, and there has always been. The strain of anti-intellectualism has been a constant thread winding its way through our political and cultural life, nurtured by the false notion that democracy means that my ignorance is just as good as your knowledge." Any guesses on who the author is?
Wink Martindale.
Scottsdale, Arizona.
Tesla. Nikola Tesla.
No, you're both wrong.
No.
Steve?
Well, I have the quote in front of me, Jay, so I'm to be cheating.
Well, then therefore you know it's from
Isaac Asimov!
Oh, to be fair, we all had it in front of us, but only some of us were willing to play along.
Oh, I thought you guys didn't have it in front of you.
Way to be a buzzkill, Steve.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yes.
Wink Martindale.
Too late. Too late to try to
Gizmo.
That's a good quote. Thanks, Jay.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
Steve, this was your finest hour.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.